Episode 62, Patrick and Cyprian speak with Georges-Olivier Raymond, CEO and founder of Pascal. The team discuss neutral atom technology, room temperature quantum computers, education, and machine learning. Welcome to Entangled Things, your quantum computing podcast, hosted by Patrick and Cyprian.
Hey, Cyprian, how are you doing today?
Hey, Patrick. I'm doing well. Looking forward for another great episode of Entangled Things.
I'm very much looking forward to this discussion today. So we're joined by George. George, can you introduce yourself to our audience, please?
Yes, sure. Hi, Patrick. Hi, Cyprian. My name is George. I'm the co-founder and CEO of a company building quantum computers. The company is based in France. We have the chance and the opportunity to have a Nobel Prize in Physics as a co-founder. And what the company is building in these quantum computers out of neutral atom technology. But I think I will give you more detail during the conversation.
Yes, this is very interesting. You're not anywhere near theoretical. You're talking about targeting 1,000 qubits in the near future. You've already got hundreds of qubits. This is very exciting, and you're using a modality that I don't hear that much about, but there's some Nobel Prize winning award science behind it. Can you tell us what your basis is?
Before that, let me just say one thing, Patrick, because
please.
I can't miss this. As being a European, right, nothing pleases me more than having on this show companies from Europe, like. We've seen a lot of stuff going on in the United States, right, and the other countries. But I'm so happy and so proud to have on the show companies from Europe that are doing this stuff. Sorry for
That's
cutting
true.
In, George, but I just had to say it.
I'm outnumbered today. but please go ahead. Neutral atom technology is my understanding.
Yes, absolutely. So we are using individual atoms as qubits. So you have to imagine that one atom equals one qubit. And we have the capability of storing the quantum information into the atoms, into the internal states of the atoms, and to make them interact thanks to laser light. Okay. And the beauty of this technology is that it's operating at room temperature. No, we do not need to cool down our system to cryogenic temperatures. And the second one is that we know we have pristine qubits built by nature. So they are perfect. We do not need to manufacture them. We just need to pick them. And they are the same every on Earth.
So you're just herding them.
Yes.
You're a qubit herder. That's awesome. Now your current processor is in the hundreds, over 300 qubits is my understanding. And I snooped around and I saw that you have a platform called Pulsar, which is near and dear to my heart because my company's name is Pulsar Security. And Pulsar lets you do simulations. It lets you understand how your circuits would go in there. Do you feel that education's a big part of your mission as well to help people understand what they can make of your technology? Is that a big challenge or is that...
It's not a big challenge. I mean, we have to teach people, but it's definitely a very dire problem in the sense that we need to foster the adoption of this new technology.
Yes.
We need to explain what the computer is good for and how it works. And that's the reason why we are developing all these tools. I mean, we have this Pulsar and Pulsar Studio to help people programming the processor and learn about it. And yes, this is really important because, I mean, you cannot just give a processor and tell the people, okay, use it.
Yeah.
I mean, it will not work this way.
Education, we've stressed that. In fact, it's probably the reason we have this podcast is we see that the education is going to be one of the limiting factors if we don't get ahead of it. But room temperature functioning qubits is a huge advantage. It's got to be, is that your primary advantage over... any other modalities, or are there other things that I don't know about neutral atom?
We do not manufacture the qubit, and it's operating at room temperature. And at the end, that's the key, the key reasons why we can scale that fast.
Yes.
As you mentioned, we have today a first devices operating in the range of 100 qubits. And as of now, we already tested it on real-world use cases with up to 60 qubits. We need to break into the next level. And in the R&D, we already have almost the next generation ready. You know, we are currently developing the new building blocks needed for this next generation, the one that will hit 1,000 qubits next year.
Wow, that's amazing.
I'm curious, can you disclose what type of atoms you are using?
Oh, absolutely. We are using rubidium. So it's an alkaline earth. The reason why we are using it is because, you know, it's well known in atomic physics. I mean, first of all, people know how to compute all the, you know, all the characteristics of the different energy states. And the other reason that is that we can control these atoms with lasers, which are coming from the telecom industry.
Wow.
So but it's by chance, of course, you know, I mean, the big advantage is that our lasers are very robust, industrialized, and they can operate 24/7.
Yeah, you basically slid into an area that's already well developed.
Exactly.
Which is perfect.
But that's the reason why, because this atom is so popular in atomic physics, because of its proximity with the lasers.
One thing that makes me very curious here is, like, traditionally with all the other modalities we see, let's say, it's relatively straightforward to build the 1-qubit gates, right? It's much more difficult to build the 2-qubit gates. So I would like to hear more about, like, how, let's say, what are some of the, not necessarily the limitations, but how are you overcoming, let's say, right, the known problems with the 2-qubit gates, like the topology, the connectivity between the qubits and things like that? Because I believe that if you are able to solve that as well, then you definitely, like, have a game changer technology at hand here.
There are many aspects to your questions, let me frame it in many ways. Let's say that we can implement gates with our technology, and as of today, I believe that there will be a couple of news in the coming weeks showing that this technology of neutral atom can implement 2-qubit gates with very high fidelity.
Wow!
It's not implemented by Pascal, but by academic labs. So it's really making huge progresses. No, the technology is still rather new. I mean, it took us basically 2 decades to develop it, to bring it where it is today. And now, I mean, we are moving fast because it is scalable and we are catching up.
Yeah.
But I mean, even though you have very high fidelity gates, 2-qubit fidelity gates, the challenge with gates, you know, is that it's not very resilient to errors. Even though your fidelity is very high, maybe with 1 or 2 nines, if you want to implement real-world use cases, you need more nines behind, you know, and it will not be ready before many years, I think. So at Pascal, we are of course following this path, developing the gates, improving them, and at the same time, because the development is entirely synergistic, we are programming the computers in a different way, which is resilient to the errors. This one. And we are not developing gates. So it's not digital. We call that analog. And the beauty is that it is resilient to errors. So basically, we can deliver value as of today, because we are not prevented to do so by the errors.
So that's interesting. So I'm thinking, what kind of scenarios are, or what class of problems are, let's say, the most suited for the approach that you have today?
I will start with a high level view. I think that optimization and machine learning in general are very well suited for the processor, because I mean, starting from this, you know, you can reframe the classical challenges into graph problems. You know, a graph is a set of nodes which are connected or not, and the beauty with neutral atoms is that we have a full control over the geometry of our qubits. So basically, we can reproduce the geometry of the graph thanks to our atoms. And it's the first step of embedding the computing challenge on the processor. And then by doing so, you can you know, by just implementing a couple of quantum operations on your set of atoms, you can find the solutions because of its geometry flexibility. you know, and without this flexibility, you know, using the brute force approach of having a fixed geometry, implementing gates, it will require hundreds of thousands of quantum operations. So I mean, it has to be compared with just a couple with the current situation. And that's the reason why we can deliver value today. So optimization, machine learning techniques, we managed to also to implement a so-called kernel. We call that quantum evolution kernel. The results were published in PRA, by the way. And it's exactly that, you know, so solving graph problems for molecule classifications, for instance, you know, predicting the toxicity.
Oh, wow. So material science, is that, there's so many things that quantum promises. There's optimization, there's material science is the one that kind of captures my imagination. And what you just said is definitely in the material science. Is that a specialty that you're going to be going for, or is it just happen to be one of the early use cases?
Oh, I think it could be one of the first use cases because, I mean, of the economic impact it can have behind. But, you know, we are talking about materials and chemistry in this case, but, you know, it's not about an ab initio simulation of an entire molecule. We are really using machine learning, so it requires less complexity at the end because we can infer the toxicity of the molecules through the through its geometry, for its shapes.
Oh, nice.
Yes. And so it's not the same challenge back, I mean, simulating ab initio the entire molecules, which is, I think, out of reach and for a long time.
Right. But you're basically taking the corpus of known molecules and which ones are toxic and feeding that in. And now, you know, so that's great. That's that you're using both quantum and AI to get to the answer. Which is something basically, probably very interesting to Cyprian. Cyprian, is that seems to be the way to go, right?
It certainly aligns with the pattern, Patrick, that we see a lot these days. I call it hybrid quantum computing, right? Where you use some capabilities around classical computing, and then you, let's say, delegate the difficult part of the problem to the quantum machine, but you are essentially doing a combination of both. Am I far from the reality here? I think this is what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, it's even more interesting, I would say. So, I mean, our first algorithm were developed by physicists, you know, I mean, very smart physicists that are able to, you know, to devise machine learning techniques. But now we are strengthening our team with, you know, with mathematicians coming from the applied physics and optimizations, and they are learning our tools. You know, they are learning our quantum solutions, and thanks to them, they can devise new workflow, which will have been completely irrelevant using only classical techniques. Because I mean, in the middle of the flow, there is a bottleneck that you cannot tackle with classical techniques. Yeah. But now with quantum computing, you can unlock this bottleneck. And, you know, they are thinking that differently, you know, devising new path that will not existing without quantum computing. And at the end, it's really hybrid, as you said, using both classical and quantum capabilities.
Which is most, you know, if we look at things like Grover or Shor's algorithm, that's the winning approach. Don't try to solve the whole problem with one tool. Use everything in your arsenal.
Yeah.
There was one thing that kind of caught my attention. So if we can get back to that a little bit, you mentioned that you can adapt essentially the topology, right, to fit the problem. So can you tell us a little bit more on how that works? Because obviously that is one of the big limitations of most of the known modalities, right? You actually need to adapt the problem to the topology, right? Because it is what it is, right? So I'd like to understand to the limits of what you can disclose to us, right? But this seems to me very, very interesting. I'd like to understand a little bit more how that works. Like, say you have a specific problem, you have a customer coming in, right? Like this is the problem you try to solve. And then how would that work from based on what your platform provides?
You mean on the hardware side?
Yes.
Is it your question? Okay. Yeah. So what we are able to do with laser beam is that we can, with one laser beam, we are able to capture, to control one qubit, one atom at a time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we call that an optical tweezer because it has the shape of a tweezer. You know, it's a highly focused beam. Yeah. So in one tweezer, you can store one qubit. And now, by adding an extra component, by adding an hologram onto this laser beam, instead of creating only one tweezer, we can create an array of tweezers. So thanks to that, we can control many, many atoms, many individual atoms. And the component creating this hologram, because it's an hologram, is a programmable component. And just by changing the way we are programming it, we can change the geometry of this array of tweezers. And this is really at will, you know? I mean, from shot to shot, we can change this geometry. And thanks to that, then, yes, we can, like you said, we can adapt the topology to fit the problem.
It sounds so simple and so hard at the same time.
Yeah, would that be far-fetched to call like programmable topology?
Yeah, I think so. You know, when I was explaining that to classical data scientists, one of them told me, but okay, it's like you have a capability of rerouting your processor. And you reroute what? To build it very efficient for a very specific use case. And I said, yes, this is exactly it.
Oh, this is totally fascinating to me. Like it's one of those things that has the potential, from my point of view, to definitely change a lot of things in
really shake things up.
A lot of things in this industry. So like kind of like the obvious question here is, how far are you from commercial availability? Are you already doing commercial projects, or do you have a roadmap?
Yeah. So absolutely, we are already ready for commercial partnerships, because we have the hardware, and the first hardware will be launched on the cloud by summer, hopefully. We are also offering the entire software stack, because we are not only building the hardware, but we are also building the stack. So the quantum solutions, as I mentioned, this so-called quantum algorithm, but also, the application side, the programming environment, and the cloud access. And on top of that, we can also provide some emulators. You know, you call that simulators, but I prefer to call them emulators, because simulator could mean something else. So an emulator is a classical software reproducing the behavior of the quantum processor at a small scale. But you know, it's enough to test and devise new algorithm. So we have the tool to do so. It's named Pulsar and Pulsar Studio. It's open source. I mean, you can have a direct access through the internet. And we are also launching the so-called Quantum Discovery Program. It's an e-learning platform where you can really learn how quantum computing is working, how neutral atoms are specific, and you can test, you can run real algorithm and tweak them. I mean, we had it some tweaks in there, so you can understand, the impact of changing the parameters. And at the end, there is also a module, to start framing the first use cases you will be interested in.
Is there a language associated? Are you using any of the existing languages, or innovating your own, or are you using a different modality than what we would think of as coding?
It's based on Python environment.
Nice.
Yes, but at the end, we are, there is a quantum language at some point. If you are familiar with quantum, you can program at this level. But most of the time, people prefer to use the libraries we've been creating.
Right.
So they can program the processor in a very quantum agnostic way. But it really depends on your skill. I mean, you can address the programming challenge at both levels.
Right. Now you mentioned cloud. Are you partnering with someone, or are you offering your own version, cloud version that you're hosting? Or are you partnering with one of the bigger cloud vendors?
We are doing both. We are building our own infrastructure, and by that, I mean, we are building the cable, allowing the people to connect to the processor. We are not building the full environment of a cloud architecture. And then we partner with the big players such as Microsoft Azure, for instance.
But nice.
With our own infrastructure, we are building this cable to plug our system to Microsoft Azure.
So you are, if I understand correctly, you are planning to offer your architecture as, let's say, an option in the Azure Quantum platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. But you can also have a direct access. Really up to the users.
Yes, I just think that's a great way to multiply your reach very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. You guys, I mean, I know you've said you've been working on this for 20 years, but you guys have come out of nowhere fairly screaming fast. So we've talked a lot about the fact that we really don't know what the modality is going to be that's going to conquer the world, and we might not have even known what it was. Even had have heard of it a few years ago. And so I really love seeing companies like yours come out and challenge the status quo and shake things up, because that's what we need.
Yeah. Indeed. The company was created only 4 years ago, actually. Wow. And now we have more than 140 employees. We raised more than $140 million in total. And yeah, indeed, we are scaling fast. I mean, because we have an amazing team, really. I mean, it's the top of the top, working hard on this on these challenges. And I think it's also the belief we had from the beginning that, first of all, neural atoms, I mean, it's a great technology which can deliver today, as we are demonstrating, but which can also deliver for the future. You know, building the gates, improving the fidelities. And finally reaching fault tolerance. Mm. And the other belief from the beginning is that, you know, we could bring solutions as of today with the existing technology.
So you know, with
my co-founders,
go ahead.
No, I mean, with my co-founders, we were really convinced that we could reach, business application in the short term.
Would it be far-fetched to say that, among other things, you are going to use this first generation of hardware that you build to develop your second generation of hardware?
Absolutely. It's exactly between the two generations, it's exactly the same technology, okay? We are adding a couple more things in there, you know, some new building blocks, but the core technology remains exactly the same. So indeed, thanks to the first generation, I mean, we are basically learning our lessons, how to build them, how to develop solutions and to test them, I mean, in real life, which is really important. Thanks to the first generation, we are also training our customers, our end users. You know, they are learning how to use the processor, what it is good for. They can develop their own tools. And at the end, they will reuse all this work with the next generation, because it's exactly the same technology. So yes, I think it's fair enough to say that we are developing our second generation thanks to the first one.
Yeah, you're basically paraphrasing Richard Campbell, who said the first sentient artificial intelligence will build the second one. So
maybe
you guys will do the material science that will change your perspective. So the element that you're using is neutral. Does that mean it's in the same family as neon and helium?
Yes. So, I mean, an atom by definition is neutral, but we really wanted to add neutral because, you know, it's different from ions. People are using the electrical charge to control the ions.
Yes.
It's the trapped ions modality.
You want to avoid ionization, because then you won't have the effects of magnetism or electromagnetism on your system.
And you know, at some point, using this electrical forces becomes a challenge to scale. You know, in an ion trap, you can control maybe 10, 20 qubits. But it seems really hard to scale further. I mean, at least with the existing technology. With neutral atoms, since we do not have a charge, we need to use other forces, which are optical forces. They are weaker than the others. So that's the reason why it took us maybe two decades, you know, to reach the point where we are today. But then you can scale faster.
Well, because there's no bleed. A laser is going to go where you point it. There's, yes, whereas exactly. With the magnetic... with electrical or magnetic, you those bleed everywhere.
Yeah, and we have 2D geometry, for instance, even 3D geometry, whereas ion trap are limited to 1D as of now. But at the end, both qubits have the same intrinsic qualities. You know, they are pristine qubits. They no need to manufacture them. They are operating at room temperature, and we are at the end controlling the quantum interaction with lasers. Hmm. But the difference with atoms is that we can scale.
Which is very important right
and
now.
And I would say room temperature is another big difference, right? Which allows you probably to scale easier because with both trapped ions and with superconducting qubits, right? What we've learned is exactly what you say is it's okay until you get to pass maybe tens of qubits. And then technically the problem of just doing the physical spacing of them to allow scaling becomes almost insurmountable because it's very difficult and you get the. But for me, what's really interesting, right, is what I see with both trapped ion and superconducting qubits is mostly the problem of topology, right? I mean, it's fairly straightforward to build a single qubit gates, but you have some severe limitations when it comes to building the two qubit gates, which gets you into all sorts of trouble. So I'm wondering, like, this is where you are right now, and you are already in a fascinating place, right? But from your point of view, I'm curious, like, what would be the next big step that you would like to achieve? Like, what would be your breakthrough number two, let's say, if there is such thing, would, let's say, allow you to further evolve your platform and your technology?
Yeah, it's a good question.
First part of the answer is that the first breakthrough is that we implemented for the first time ever real world applications. We did that with Crédit Agricole, and also with a bank, but also internally with our toxicity classifier. And since we were using real world data, we were able to benchmark our results against classical solutions. That's the first time ever. And what we measure is that we are at the same level. And people are calling and people are calling that enterprise grade readiness, because we start bringing value, we start being in the same range of performance. And of course, the next step, the next breakthrough is to beat classical solutions. And now we know what to do, because we know where we stand compared to them. We need a couple more qubits. We need maybe more flexibility in the control of these qubits. But we have that in our roadmap. So in 1 or 2 years, our next leap is to do the same, but this time to beat classical solutions. Basically, to reach a true quantum advantage.
Yeah, you actually preempted my next question. Like, are you? How far are you from exhibiting quantum advantage? But you've just answered that, and I think it's fascinating from the point of view of even being today. Like, people sometimes react to, oh, so what's the big deal? You just proved that you can match the performance of classical computing, right? In essence, it is a huge deal, right?
Absolutely. Because, thank you.
Because with many other modalities, we're still just hypothesizing that we can match the performance of classical computing, right? Having a proof that you can match is already a huge deal, and I can't emphasize that enough.
If a 2-year-old beat a 30-year-old at something, we would pay attention. And so
exactly. I mean, people tend to forget that. I mean, when you are implementing a quantum solution, that's the first time ever. So of course there is room for improvement, and you benchmark yourself against classical solutions that have been owned for decades.
Yes,
which are highly efficient, and it's really hard.
Yeah. So to be able to catch up with that shows that the promise is dramatic.
Yes.
We're still at the we're probably in the middle of the beginning, is what I like to say, of the quantum revolution. We're not in the beginning because of companies like yours. If it weren't for companies like yours, we would have to say we're still in the beginning of the beginning. But you have an actual quantum computer. And it wasn't many years ago when Cyprian and I were talking at conferences and saying, wouldn't it be great when they actually have real quantum computers? And now they are, you know, no matter how big. That's great. Is yeah. So 1,000 is the official stance of where you're going next. Is there a tentative timeline for what's after that, or is that still close to the vest?
So we are on track with this vision of reaching 1,000 qubit. I mean, this year at an R&D level, and then we will demonstrate the quantum advantage thanks to that next year, and then we will be able to go to the market with this technology. And so basically this is building our flagship product.
Okay.
But at the same time, we are also developing the technology. I mean, as I mentioned, it can deliver today, building this first 2 generation, but we also have planned to build the 3rd generation, you know, increasing even more the qubit numbers, improving the fidelities of the operations, and in some way find some, you know, a new architecture to reach fault tolerance and quantum error corrections. This is longer term, okay?
Yeah.
Maybe we are talking about 10 years, maybe more, but still okay. it's on the map, and we have ideas to do that.
Cool. Well, and being part of Microsoft's ecosystem and having your own ecosystems means that you're open for business. You're capable of doing real stuff. And it's amazing what people will innovate. When I've built software solutions for all sorts of things, and people surprise you. The users end up doing things you never imagined them doing. And with hardware, it's triply so, you know. So you're going to be surprised by what the market does with your machines, I'm sure.
I hope so. That's the bet, you know. We really want to address customers as much as possible in order to benefit from this kind of surprise. Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering. Sorry, Patrick. Go ahead.
I was just going to say we're at about 30 minutes, so we got a little bit of time left. So we probably have to come up with our last. A bit of topic. So go ahead, Cyprian.
No, I just wanted to ask, like, because you mentioned also that you are not only in the business of building the hardware itself, right? You're building the stack, and then you're also building learning materials, right? So I wanted to ask you, like, what's your perspective on the learning curve today, right? We see broadly two categories, right? One which is very large, which is everyone who's biased, so to speak, quote unquote, by classical computing, right? Meaning they need to transition somehow from things that they've learned for classical computing, which includes myself and Patrick and many other people, right? And then we see this emerging category of what we call like a quantum born or born in quantum, which have their first kind of contact with the computing idea directly with quantum, so without actually being biased in any way by classical. So I was wondering how do you see this space, and how difficult do you think it's going to be to educate the broader market, to create those resources, those human resources that are actually going to be the users of your quantum computer? Because both Patrick and I, we think that yes, in the beginning, the use cases are limited, and the, let's say, number of people that you need to understand these things is going to be limited. But in order for this to succeed long term, we need to create a critical mass, right? Pretty much the same way it happened with classical computing. So I would really like to understand your view on how is this happening today? What are some of the challenges? And frankly, what do you see? What is your experience with the learning part?
It's a very interesting question. Well, first of all, I would say that, I mean, people are learning very fast, and I'm always impressed by that. I mean, for instance, when we organize hackathon, you know, I mean, people are learning in a couple of days how to program the processor, and finally to be able to devise something relevant at the end, just in a couple of days. And that's very amazing. I'm also amazed by how fast our classical data scientists learn our tools, and now is able, you know, is able to make demonstration like this to catch the is able to catch how to apply our solution to classical problems, and that's really amazing. So people can learn fast, And at the same time, you know, there is a huge excitement about learning quantum. So, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's the technical challenge of the 21st century. You know, it's like building the space industry back to the 70s. So people are really excited about that. They know that it's the future. So the students want to learn. You know, now there are quantum tracks in many universities. And as of Pascal, I mean, our challenge is really, yes, to educate these people and to bring them to our technology. So we are developing the tools. We are working with the universities in order to do so. We have this e-learning platform. It's really about, you know, yes,
evangelism.
Yes, thank you.
No problem.
Thank you for helping me.
That's a tough one. evangelism is big because people don't know what they don't know. And we're just starting. We talked to a high school teacher in Brooklyn who's teaching it at the high school level, quantum computing. Mm-hmm. And so that's exciting. And again, middle of the beginning. Maybe we'll get to a point where this is just common knowledge, but I still get people who look at me sideways when I mention quantum computing. So we still have some work to be done.
Well, in light of recent events, Patrick, even the space industry still has some significant challenges to overcome, it seems. So
That's true. We have a friend who watches rocketry quite well. One of our first guests on the show, Richard Campbell. And he was quite impressed by how well it didn't blow up while it was tumbling. We're talking, of course, about the SpaceX launch. You know, if that's what you're calling success, and that's fine as long as you learn from it, right?
It's a bumpy ride, like no matter how you look at it, Patrick.
I'm glad I wasn't riding that rocket, but yes, I agree with you. So George, fabulous talking to you. Very much appreciate your time. Looking forward to watching what you do and hope you rejoin us. And of course, if you're in our neighborhoods, happy to, pick your brain and have dinner with you. Anything else you want to say before we kind of wrap things up? Because we're coming up on time.
It's okay on my side. I mean, I would just ask the people who will listen to our discussion, I mean, to really try our tool, Pulsar and Pulsar Studio. It's that easy, I mean, to have access to them. Go on our website, and it's also easy to use. And that's the best way to train and learn.
I love the name, so and the idea behind it. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it, and thanks for everybody who's listening.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure, George.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you.